Audible Studios presents Vengeance of the Iron Dwarf, Legend of Drizzt, Companions Codex, Book 3. Written by R.A. Salvatore. Performed by Victor Bavin.
Prologue. It was a solemn greeting at the underground western gates of Citadel Felbar on the first day of the second Tenday in the 11th month of Uktar. The first snows had fallen in the upper Cerbrin Vale, and the white coating already reached low among the Rauven Mountains above the Dwarven Fortress. But if the Orc hordes now controlling what was left of once mighty Sundabar, or those in sacked Nesme, or besieging mighty Silvery Moon, or camped around the Dwarven citadels of Mithril Hall, Feldbar, and Adbar, had any intention of packing up and returning to Dark Arrow Keep, or to anywhere else within the accepted boundaries of the Kingdom of Many Arrows, they didn't show it. Nor were the vast networks of upper dark tunnels clearing of invaders, as the procession from Mithril Hall discovered on their journey to the planned council at Citadel Felbar. For nearly the entire month of Marpanoth and into Uktar, the legion of battle dwarves surrounding King Conorad Braunanvil and his distinguished entourage had fought their way from waypoint to waypoint, regions the dwarves of Mithril Hall and Felbar had strongly secured, heavily fortified and well supplied, in their long underground journey to the halls of King Emerus Warcrown. Emerus himself was there to greet the dwarves of Mithril Hall. They were a 10-day overdue. That had all been explained, and the actual arrival announced well in advance, thanks to the cunning dwarves of the Silver Marches, who had set up elaborate messaging systems through their connecting tunnels. Sideslinger Ballasty would hurl messages rolled and tucked into hollow darts down long tunnels to be retrieved at the next guard post, and there loaded again and sent flying along. Unless a section of the secured tunnels had been overrun by orcs and their allies, a message from King Conorad to King Emerus could be sent the 200 miles in just a few days.
"Well met, King Conorad,"
Emerus said as he wrapped his peer in a great hug to the cheers from his fellows gathered at Citadel Felbar's gate.
"Ah, but we've been concerned, me friend. I, the vermin, are learning of our main boulevard, and poking and prodding all about,"
Conorad replied.
"Me and me boys had to stop and help along the way. Or might be that our warriors down there didn't need our help, but we just wanted to punch a few orcs, eh?"
That brought a cheer from the dwarves of both camps.
"Aye, but the meeting ye asked for can wait until a few orcs are killed,"
Emerus agreed.
"Ye surprised meself and the dwarves of Adbar in calling it, with such grim news dancing all about."
Conorad nodded and pulled off his metal gauntlets.
"Bring some fellows with me you might be knowing," he explained. "And when you're seeing the truth, you'll know why I called us all together."
Emerus nodded, putting a curious look on his face as he glanced past Conorad to the group of newcomers still out in the hallway, just beyond the immediate torchlight. Conorad followed his lead and glanced around. With a knowing grin, King Conorad waved the rogue drow, Drizzt O'Urden, forward.
"Aye, I expect you're knowing this one, then,"
Conorad said as Drizzt stepped up and bowed before the old King Emerus.
"Drizzt O'Urden,"
Emerus remarked, nodding.
"It has been many years since ye've been in the Silver Marches, old friend of King Brunner."
"Too many, it would seem," the drow answered, and extended his hand, which Emerus clasped and shook warmly. The curious manner in which Emerus had spoken of him, as a friend of Brunner, surely didn't slip past Drizzt or Conorad.
"These drow leading the orcs claim,"
Emerus began.
"To be of my house, yes,"
Drizzt interrupted. "Though I beg to differ. There is no house, O'Urden, good King Emerus. Or at least, there is no house, O'Urden, of which I have been aware for many decades now."
"So ye deny these drow be your kin?"
"Kin, perhaps," Drizzt replied with a shrug. "I deny any foreknowledge of this attack, if that is what you mean to ask me."
and deny that yourself was sent here to bring about the conception of many arrows, and so in the end to bring about this very war?" the old dwarf king asked. Still he held tight to Driz's hand. Tighter even, squeezing as if the handshake was as much a test as this blunt line of questioning.
"Bah! But shut your mouth!"
roared a familiar voice from behind. One familiar to Drizzt and Conorad, and also to King Emerus and the dwarf named Ragged Dane, who stood behind the King of Felbar. All glanced that way to see a young dwarf with a fiery reddish-orange beard hopping out from among the others.
"Little Arar!"
Ragged Dane cried, both in surprise and to scold the impetuous young warrior. The dwarf came forward, looking very much like he would put his fist into King Emerus's old face, until Conorad stopped him with a shout.
"It is not time for this, Mr. Reginald Roundshield."
The young dwarf paused and put his hands on his hips. He looked to Drizzt, who nodded and grumbled as he went back to the group to stand beside a fair-haired human woman. Ragged Dane continued to glower at the fellow, though he whispered to the others around him.
"Ye be at your ease, Mr. Dowarden. None outside the human cities are thinking bad of King Brunner and his old friends." "Bring your boys in," Emerus bade Conorad. "All of them. We'll show ye to your rooms and show ye proper Felbar hospitality, don't ye doubt."
"Show me boys to their rooms," Conorad replied. "For meself and a few others, show us to the gathering at your table. I've much to tell ye, and it's not for waiting. Get King Harnoth and his boys, and let's get to talking."
King Emerus shook his head.
"King Harnoth didn't come," he explained,
and Conorad's eyes went wide.
"I begged ye all."
"His seconds are here," King Emerus explained, "and we'll collect them for your talk."
He looked to Ragged Dane and nodded.
"Take Conorad and them he wants aside him to the table."
Huffing and puffing, Franco Olbert stumbled up against the thick trunk of a tree. He dared a glance back across the snowy field to the distant wall of the town that had been his home for most of his life. But though the skyline of Nesme was surely familiar, Franco could not look upon that blasted and cursed place as his home. Not since the orcs had come. Not since the drow had come. Not since Duke Tiago Dowarden had come. He started away once more, determined to get to the Uthgard tribes, to raise an army, to find some way to repay the monstrous scum. His mother was Uthgard. He knew their language, their ways, their pride. The proud barbarians would not suffer the orcs and dark elves to hold a city so near their borders. Franco slipped away from the tree to another, then made a short run to a copse not far from there. He paused when he saw the human form lying on the ground face down. The fallen man was dressed in armor, plate mail mostly, and with a full helm like some knight from Everlund. The escapee hesitated and looked around cautiously. There were no signs of a struggle, other than the clear implications that this man was quite dead. He wasn't moving at all, set in the snow in an awkward and broken pose, with the stillness Franco had seen all too often since the monstrous horde had poured over Nesme. Seeing no one around, the escapee inched his way toward the fallen knight. He gingerly grabbed the dead warrior by his arm and turned him a bit so he could look into the man's face. He shuddered at the gruesome visage. One eye had been pecked out, with more than half the poor man's face shredded and torn. Franco dropped the corpse back down to the snow, then fell back into a sitting position, forcing some deep breaths to help steady himself. He noted the man's sword poking out from under one hip, and he was fast to it, easing it out of its sheath. Franco was an accomplished warrior, had ridden with the riders of Nesme, and he knew weapons. This one was fine indeed. And so was the armor, he noted, and the man was almost exactly his size.
"Thank you, brother,"
he said with respect. And he went to the man and began his looting. With every piece he put on, the greaves, the breastplate, the pauldrons, Franco grew more confident. He strapped on the sword belt and breathed a sigh of relief. Even if his pursuers caught up to him now, he knew he would die a warrior, and Franco could ask for no more than that, particularly given the torturous executions he had witnessed in Nesme under the cruel gaze of the tyrant Duke Tiago. The city stank of bloated corpses. "I should bury you, friend, but I haven't the time," he whispered. "Please forgive me leaving you to the crows. Please forgive me stealing your sword. But never would I steal your honor." He knelt and said an Uthgard prayer for the spirit of the dead man, then removed the dead man's helmet, gently and respectfully pulling it free of the torn head. Before Franco had even brought it back, he understood something was amiss. He plopped the helmet on his head and jumped to his feet, determined to be away quickly. But even as he took his first stride, he was stopped by curiosity and turned back. Something nagged at him just beyond his conscious recognition. The wounds on the back? He turned back to the corpse, and this time suppressed his revulsion to take a good look at the poor man. The corpse had been rolled over in the process of looting it, and that shredded face was clear to see. "Marquin," he gasped, and he looked closer, confirming his suspicion. "Marquin," he said, for surely this was the warrior Marquin of Silvery Moon, who had moved to Nesme a decade before. Franco's shock turned quickly to confusion. He had seen Marquin die just a 10 day earlier as part of the executions in the open square in Nesme. Marquin had been tied to a pair of stakes and beaten mercilessly by Tiago's wife. Franco had watched as the vile Duchess Sarabel de Werden had put her awful, venomous, snake-headed whip to its cruel work. Again and again the serpent struck, tearing Marquin's shirt, tearing his flesh, filling him with poisonous fire. And there was the tattered, bloody shirt. And Franco didn't have to pull the ripped strands aside to know that the viper wounds were there in the flesh. Aye, this was Marquin. And Franco had watched Marquin die. So how was he out here in the snow, a mile from the city, dressed in armor and carrying a sword? "By the gods," Franco whispered, figuring it out, and he leaped to his feet and ran off at full speed. He neared a small ravine and didn't dare slow. Not until he was struck blind. No, not blind, Franco realized, as he stumbled over the ledge and tumbled down, falling out of the globe of magical darkness. He felt his shoulder pop out as he crashed into the rocky dell, but came right up and threw himself hard into a tree, jamming his limb back in place. He ignored the waves of nausea and the dimming consciousness. He had no time for that. Indeed, Franco had no time at all, as he learned when he spun to find a small but deadly figure standing in front of him, looking quite amused. Duke Tiago of Nesme. The drow smiled and raised his gloved hands, his small, translucent buckler strapped to his left forearm, and began to clap. "You did well, Iblith," Tiago said. "You traveled farther than I expected. A most worthy hunt, considering my prey is no more than a pathetic human." Franco glanced around, expecting to see some orc archers or a giant holding a boulder nearby, or another drow. "It is just me," Tiago assured him. "Why would I need more?" As he finished, he held out his arms. And Franco leaped at him, sword cutting for the foul drow's head. But up came the shield, and its edge spiraled magically as it did. With each turn, the magnificent shield enlarged, and behind it, Tiago easily ducked the blow. And out came the drow's sword, so fast that Franco didn't register the movement or hear the star-filled blade sliding free of its scabbard. Franco felt the bite of the tip, though, as it pierced his thigh. He grimaced and fell back into a defensive crouch, his sword slashing out sidelong to keep his enemy at bay. But Tiago wasn't advancing. Instead, he moved easily, circling Franco, just out of reach. "Fight," the drow said. "There is only me. I've no friends nearby. Only me, only Tiago, standing between you and your freedom." "You think this sport?" Franco spat at him, and he rushed and chopped with his sword, cleverly, he thought, pulling up short and breaking his momentum to stab straight ahead. "Is it anything less?" a laughing Tiago said from back the other way, having somehow eluded Franco's attack so fully that the stabbing sword was farther from Tiago's flesh than it had been before Franco began the strike. Franco licked his lips. The extent of that miss wasn't promising. "Just me," Tiago teased, circling back the other way. Franco, too, began to circle, studying the area to see if he might find some advantage in the uneven ground, trees, and rocks. "Is that not a fair game, human?" Tiago asked. "I even armed and armored you, finely so. I could have struck you dead while you robbed the corpse. I could have stopped you from fleeing Nesme. 12 archers watched you run out. They had their bows trained upon you, even as you squeezed through the crack in the wall. I held their shots. I gave you a chance. All you need to do is defeat me. And as you're nearly twice my size, that should prove simple enough." His voice never strained, never lost its composure, even though Franco came on in mid-speech, ferociously chopping and stabbing, pressing ahead, trying to simply overwhelm the diminutive drow. "Though I admit you are a bit clumsy," Tiago added. And that last sentence was spoken from behind Franco, as the drow's sword slashed across the man's calf, tearing a painful line. Franco turned and slashed with his blade and staggered, hopping up on one foot as fiery agony filled his other leg. Ahead sprang Tiago, his sword poking forward and turning subtly to avoid the desperate parry, slipping past to prod Franco in the shoulder, in the crease between breastplate and pauldron. The blade came again, stabbing a second time in the same place, and ahead yet again, and this time, as Franco wildly tried to protect that burning shoulder, Tiago shifted Vidrinath the other way, taking Franco in the crease between his right pauldron and breastplate. The man fell back, waving his sword wildly to fend off the drow, who was not pursuing. As Franco's weight came down on his torn leg, he stumbled and fell over backward, wildly trying to right himself, slashing his blade, desperate to keep the drow at bay. Except the drow was still standing, back where he had stabbed the man. Franco stared at him, hard and determined, pulling himself back to his feet, hating this drow all the more. Tiago was playing with him, taunting him by refusing to press the advantage. Supremely confident. Franco silently berated himself. He was overplaying his hand. Perhaps it was the size difference, as Tiago had hinted. Or maybe Franco's supreme hatred of this false tyrant duke had stolen his better judgment. He knew he was a better fighter by far than he was showing against Tiago. He was a rider of Nesme, finely trained, and he knew better than to give in to his anger. He told himself all of that, replayed the drow's maneuvers, and nodded quietly as he considered a better approach to engage this skilled swordsman. He moved ahead slowly. Tiago stood there, his left hand on his hip, his sword tip down to the ground at his right side. Tiago's posture invited a fierce attack. But Franco paced himself this time, eased his way forward, and kept his sword in tight defensively. He understood now that Tiago's seemingly unprepared posture was just that, seemingly. The drow reacted too quickly for him to hope for an open strike, and indeed the overbalancing thrust would get him stabbed yet again. But now he knew. He stepped his sword ahead in a measured and balanced thrust, a lazy and meaningless attack. Too lazy, Franco thought. Too slow. And his arms were too heavy. He didn't understand. He didn't know the more common name of Tiago's sword, Lullaby, and didn't know that each strike had sent sleeping poison coursing into his body and blood. But he knew that he was sluggish, and so he reached his sword out once more to keep the drow at bay until he could sort it out. The drow wasn't there. Franco heard a laugh behind him, and he swung around as quickly as he could manage, sweeping his sword. It got halfway around, but no more, met with a sudden and vicious uppercut by Vidrinath. Franco's sword went flying away, his severed hand still gripping it. The man brought the stump of his arm in close, crying in pain and shock, hugging tight his bloody wrist. "Run away," Tiago said teasingly, and stabbed him again, this time in his fleshy rump. "Flee, you fool!" He struck Franco again, and the man began his run, and Tiago was close behind, poking him painfully. Then Tiago was beside him, taunting him, sticking him repeatedly, but never deeply, never a wound to kill him. Desperate now, Franco threw himself at the drow, but the drow was too quick and kicked out his ankles, dropping him hard to the ground. And in came Vidrinath, and a sizable piece of Franco's right ear flew away. He was crying, frustrated and angry and hurt, but he stubbornly got his legs under him and began stumbling away. And again Tiago paced him. "You human," the drow said. "Yes, you, you fool!" His sword tapped Franco on the shoulder, but didn't cut into any flesh this time, but rather pointed ahead. "You see that clearing beyond the birch?" Tiago asked. "Run, fool. If you get there, I will not pursue you further." He ended with a hard slap across Franco's rump with the flat of his blade. "Ah, but you are too tired," Tiago teased, pacing the man just behind, close enough to kill Franco with an easy thrust. "Your legs are heavy. Aye, you can barely stay upright. Oh, fie, but then I'll have to kill you." He poked Franco in the rump again and twisted his blade painfully for good measure. Tiago's laugh chased him. But Franco had an idea now. He felt as though he'd gained some insight into the sadistic drow. He slowed even more and staggered sideways as much as forward with every step. He didn't think Tiago would kill him until the last moment, until he reached the birch tree, and he used that knowledge to change the cadence of the pursuit. He got stabbed again, repeatedly, but never more than superficially, never intended to inflict true damage, but always to inflict more pain. But he held his course, his ruse. The birch was close now. Franco stumbled and started to fall, enough to look good, but he burst ahead suddenly, using every ounce of weary strength he could muster to propel him to the birch tree and past it, diving out into the clearing. He rolled onto his back, expecting the treacherous drow to be right above him, ready to kill him. To his surprise, though, indeed to his shock, Tiago had not come out past the birch. "Well played," the self-proclaimed Duke of Nesme said, and he tipped his sword in salute. "Come on, then," Franco yelled at him, certain it was all a cruel taunt. "I am a drow of my word, fool," Tiago said. "I am a royal duke, after all. I promised that I would pursue you no further, and so I shan't. Indeed, you are free of my blade, though I expect your wounds to take you in the forest. If not, then you'll come back, of course, with some pitiful army, and I will find you again and finish my kill. Next time I will start with your eyes, so that you will not see the next blow falling. Ah, but you will hear me, and that voice, my voice, will frighten you, for it will portend the fall of Vidrinath upon your exposed flesh." And he laughed an awful laugh as Franco stumbled away across the wide field. He kept looking back, but Tiago was not pursuing. So he turned ahead, determined to find the Uthgard, determined. The ground erupted in front of him, and a beast, gleaming stark white and colder than winter itself, came up from the snow. "Oh, fie," Tiago lamented behind him. "Did I not warn you that my dragon was waiting?" Franco screamed, feeling the warmth of his own piss running down his leg when those terrible jaws opened wide, spear-like teeth closing around him. Up he went into the air, sidelong in the dragon's maw, legs hanging out one side, head and shoulders out the other. He kept screaming, but the dragon didn't bite down. Or maybe it did and he was already dead and just hadn't realized it yet. He couldn't know. "I do find this enjoyable," Tiago whispered in his ear. Jolted by the voice so near, Franco composed himself just enough to turn and look the drow in the eye. And in came the sword, surgically, and Franco's right eye flipped free into the drow's waiting hand. "Dear Orothiter," Tiago said to the dragon, "pray do not bite the life from him. Nay, swallow this proud one whole, that he can lay pressed in your belly, your juices melting him to nothingness." The dragon issued a long, low growl. "He has no blade, I promise," Tiago assured the beast. Up went the head, tossing poor Franco inside, and down he went into the beast, helpless.
"I feel more like a snake than a worm," Orothiter complained.
"Is he wriggling?" the drow asked. The dragon paused in a pensive pose.
"Whimpering, I think,"
he answered. "Good, good," said Tiago. "Are you done with your silly game, husband?" asked another voice, and Tiago turned to see the approach of Sarabel. "I must find my pleasure where I can," he said. "Would that I could fly the old white death over Silvery Moon to drop stones on the fools within. Would that I could assail Everlund." "You cannot," Sarabel scolded. Tiago couldn't argue. That command had come from matron mother Quenthel Beanry herself. They were to sit quietly in their conquered lands and vast encampments. "Let the folk of the Silver Marches take hope that the spring will bring relief," was Matron Mother Quenthel's command. Tiago understood the implications all too well, as did Sarabel. The Matron Mother was making sure that no other surface kingdoms from beyond the Silver Marches alliance of Lorwar became involved in this war. The drow incursion could inspire no terror beyond the north. They would involve none but those kingdoms they had used their orc fodder to assail. No one would raise an army and fight here because there was no ultimate victory, no lasting gains of land and conquest to be found here, not on the battlefield at least. The campaign had never been about that. "We have pressed them to the edge of doom, and we will let them wriggle free," Tiago said. He turned to the dragon. "But that one will not." Orothiter laughed, a strange and unnerving rumble, then belched, and from deep inside, a muffled cry of hopelessness and pain accompanied the burp. "It is not about our victory," Tiago said accusatorily. Sarabel held her ground and even looked at him rather condescendingly. "Define victory," she said. "It is about Matron Mother Quenthel securing her hold on Menzo Berenzon," said Tiago. "You would wish differently? She is our benefactor, our reason for existence. House Doerden is the domain of the Matron Mother, as surely as are the halls of House Beanry you walked as a child." Tiago muttered a curse under his breath and turned away. He was full of battle lust, craving victory and glory, and these pitiful hunting games he allowed himself with the captives of Nesme were growing older and more boring with each tormented kill. "We have already achieved victory," Sarabel said. "Quenthel has," Tiago spat before he could properly voice the name, and he blanched when the whip appeared in Sarabel's hand, and when Orothiter's toothy maw moved right beside him, reminding him so poignantly that the word of the Matron Mother, and thus the word of her priestesses, outranked the demands of the Duke of Nesme. "Matron Mother Quenthel," he said, and lowered his eyes. He silently told himself, though, that if Sarabel struck at him with that whip, he would kill her then and there, and hopefully be done with the witch before the dragon ate him. In that event, with Sarabel, the only witness, lying dead, perhaps he could convince Greater Rothiter that eating him would only complicate things. But the blow from Sarabel's whip did not fall. "Be of good spirit, husband, for we too have won," Sarabel said, and replaced the weapon on her belt. Tiago looked up at her and growled. "We will be recalled soon." Sarabel nodded. "And even now we can return to the city with dignity, as heroes of Menzo Berenzon, victorious in the glorious campaign, and so take our place as royals of House de Werden." Tiago started to respond, but paused as he considered the light-hearted, joyous tone of Sarabel. His eyes widened as he figured it out. "You expect to replace her," he said. "Darthir, matron mother of House de Werden, you expect—" He stopped and stared, Sarabel's expression giving no indication that she meant to argue the point. And as he thought of it, as he thought of broken Dahlia, he found that he too could come to no other conclusion as to where all of this was leading. For Dahlia was Darthir, a surface elf, and her appointment as matron mother of House de Werden had been no more than a cruel joke matron mother Quenthel had perpetrated on the ruling council, an insult to the very traditions of the drow, of the unending hatred the dark elves held for their surface cousins. Quenthel had elevated Dahlia for no better reason than to prove that she could, and to prove, even more poignantly, that there was nothing the other matron mothers could do about it. And so, yes, it all made sense that Sarabel, noble daughter of House Orlaren, would ascend to House de Werden's ruling seat when the filthy Dahlia had outlived her usefulness.
"Ah, but sure you're to fit in the line of Battlehammer Kings," Ragged Dane said to King Conorad as they made their way to the court of Citadel Felbar, Conorad's chosen entourage in tow. General Dagnabbit and Bungalow Thump were among that group, along with Little R.R. and another tough, black-bearded fellow Ragged Dane did not know. But so were Drizzt O'Erden and a human lass.
"Never could stick to your own kind, ye danged battle-hammers," Ragged Dane teased. "Even when old King Brunner went hunting for Mithril Hall. Bah, but he was the only dwarf among that group what found the place."
Conorad laughed the good-natured jab away, but he knew it was true enough. In the war with the first Obuld a century before, Conorad's own father, the great Baenak, had been overlooked as steward when Brunner had fallen in battle. On Brunner's orders, a halfling had taken control of Mithril Hall. A halfling, and with an army of decorated dwarves ready to step in. Conorad couldn't suppress a glance back at the dwarf he knew to be Brunner as he considered the insult to his father. Baenak Braunanvil had brushed the whole incident away, mitigating the sting, and reminding his son that Regis had been beside Brunner as friend and confidant for years and knew the old dwarf's heart better than anyone. The young dwarf in the procession noted Conorad's glance and offered him a knowing wink, and Conorad found that his anger, what little there was, couldn't hold. Brunner had honored his father and family in the end, elevating the Braunanvils to the throne of Mithril Hall.
"And how about yourself, Little R.R.?"
Ragged Dane said when they entered the gathering hall.
"Ye done good for yourself, so it's seeming. So are ye meaning to sit with the Battlehammers, or with your own a Felbar? And when are ye to go and see your dear Ma Eoin? Did ye even send word to her, then? Tell her that ye've returned."
The young dwarf nodded.
"Battlehammers," he said gruffly. "That's me place above all." "Your ma might not be agreeing," Ragged Dane teased.
"Me ma's to find a lot to scramble her brain, don't ye doubt,"
the red-bearded young dwarf replied, and he snorted in emphasis. The seven representatives of Mithril Hall took their seats on their appointed side of the triangular table King Emerus had constructed specially for meetings of the three citadels. General Dagnabbit, Bungalow Thump, and Brunner sat to Conorad's right, Athrogate, Drizzt, and Catti Bree to the young king's left. King Emerus entered soon after and took his place, flanked by Ragged Dane and Parson Glaive. And last came the delegation, six dwarf officers from Citadel Adbar, led by the fierce Orethios Spikes of the battle-raging wild dwarves. After proper greetings, promises of friendship, eternal alliance, and no small amount of ale, King Emerus called the chamber to order and turned the proceedings over to King Conorad.
"What news from Mithril Hall, then?"
Emerus bade his young but respected peer.
"Ye promised us great tidings, and I'm meaning to hold ye to 'em." "Aye, but we could all use a bit of good news, then,"
Orethios Spikes added, and lifted his tankard in toast.
"Ye see that me friend here, Drizzt O'Erden, has returned to our side,"
King Conorad began, and he paused and looked to the dark elf ranger. The dwarves at the other sides of the triangular table did bristle a bit, but ultimately lifted their tankards in toast to Drizzt. Conorad offered Drizzt the floor.
"I fought at the defense of Nesme," Drizzt began.
"Nesme has fallen,"
King Emerus interrupted. And the expressions on the faces of the Battlehammer contingent and those from Citadel Adbar showed that to be new information indeed.
"Bah!"
Athrogate snorted.
"But we knowed she couldn't be holding for long." "A dragon arrived to bolster the Many Arrows horde,"
King Emerus explained.
"One ridden by a drow elf calling himself D'Orden."
More grumbles came from the Adbar dwarves at that. But the Felbarns remained stoic, having clearly already digested the news.
"I can say nothing to that claim," Drizzt replied honestly. "There is no surviving House D'Orden that I know of, but I have not been to the city of my birth in long over a century now, and have no hopes or desires to ever return."
He paused, and all eyes went to King Emerus, who nodded solemnly, indicating his acceptance of the explanation.
"My party was returning to Mithril Hall when we encountered this strange, darkened sky," Drizzt explained. "Then we encountered the western flank of the Orc line camped outside of Nesme."
"Tricked 'em good,"
Athrogate put in.
"Good enough for them to sack the town, so it's seeming," King Emerus said dryly. "Bah, but it take them long enough,"
Athrogate roared in protest.
"And know that the fields are filled with Orc dead."
"The town has fallen, so you say, and so it must be," Drizzt interjected. "It had not when my friends and I left through the tunnels of the Upper Dark to get to Mithril Hall. Be assured that the taking of Nesme was no easy task for the hordes of Many Arrows. Thousands of goblins and orcs were slaughtered at her walls before we departed, and with a rotting stench of dead ogres and giants among them. They came against Nesme's walls day after day, and day after day they were slaughtered."
"This I have heard," Emerus admitted. "And yourself played a role in that?"
"Aye," said Drizzt. "As did Athrogate of Felbar here."
He patted Athrogate's strong shoulder, but the dwarf's eyes widened, and he looked up at Drizzt, seeming near panic.
"Felbar!"
King Emerus said, obviously caught by surprise. He looked to Parson Glaive, who could only shrug in confusion.
"I be so much older than I'm looking," Athrogate admitted. "Was here when Obold took the place. Didn't dare return."
The Felbar dwarves all glanced around, exchanging doubtful looks indeed.
"Not for mattering," Athrogate said. "Ain't called Felbar me home in two dwarves' lifetimes. Just Athrogate now, just Athrogate." "We will talk, yourself and meself," King Emerus said.
And Athrogate looked back over his shoulder and cast a sour glance at Drizzt, who just patted him on the shoulder again.
"Athrogate was a hero of Nesme," Drizzt said,
and he moved to stand behind Catti Bree, dropping his hands on her strong shoulders.
"As was this woman, my wife."
"Ye seem to be favoring human lasses with that fire hair, what ho?"
Ragged Dane declared, and he lifted his tankard in toast to the woman.
"Indeed," Drizzt agreed.
and that will be explained shortly, I expect. Perhaps even by the fourth of my party who joins us this day. He stepped to the side of Catti Bree and leaned over the table, nodding down the other end of the battlehammer line to his dear friend, who nodded back.
Little Arar?
King Emrys asked with surprise.
So you're with this one now, then, and not with the battlehammers?
With both,
Bruna replied. Emrys gave a snort and shook his head.
Tail's already got me head spinning,
Orethio Spike said from the Adbar side.
Oh, but ye ain't heard nothing yet, King Conorad assured him, assured all of them.
And he lifted his pack from the floor and plopped it on the table in front of him, then reverently opened it to reveal a peculiar one-horned helmet.
Ye e'er seen one akin to it?
He asked King Emrys.
Looks like Brunner's own,
the King of Felbar replied. Conorad nodded, then suddenly slid the fabled item along the table to his right, past Dagnabbit and Bungalow Thump, to the waiting hands of little Arar.
Eh?
King Emrys and several others asked together. Little Arar lifted the one-horned helm in his strong hands and rolled it around, looking it over from every angle. Then, looking straight at Emrys, he plopped the helm, the old crown of Mithril Hall, atop his head.
"Here now, what are ye about?"
King Emrys demanded.
"You're not knowing me, then?" Brunner asked slyly.
"After all, we've been through together."
Emrys wore a curious expression and turned to Conorad for an answer.
"That one there, the one ye were knowing as little Arar, son of Reginald Roundshield and Eoin,"
Conorad began, and he paused and collected his breath, even shaking his head as if he too could hardly believe what he was about to declare.
"Me name's Brunner,"
the young dwarf in the one-horned helm interjected.
"Brunner Battlehammer, 8th king and 10th king of Mithril Hall, son of Bangor, me da, who ye knowed well, me friend Emrys. Aye, son of Bangor, that'd be me." "Ye dishonor your maw!"
Ragged Dane scolded and came forward over the table threateningly, but Brunner didn't blink.
"And so too, son of Reginald Roundshield," he said. "And born again of Eoin, me maw, and she's a fine one, don't ye doubt?"
"Delusion!"
Ragged Dane insisted.
"Blasphemy!"
added Orethio Spikes.
"Truth in telling," Brunner spat at both of them. "Brunner's me name, the one given me by me da, Bangor."
"Ye cannot believe this,"
King Emrys said to Conorad. He turned fast to Driz, though, as he spoke.
"Surely yourself's no one better."
"Brunner," Driz said slowly and deliberately, nodding. "It is."
"Don't you know him then, King Emrys?"
asked the woman beside Driz.
"And don't you recognize me?"
"Now, how might I be doing that?"
Emrys asked, or almost asked. The last word caught in his throat as he took a closer look at this auburn-haired young woman sitting beside the dark elf.
"By the gods,"
he muttered.
"Catti Bree?"
Ragged Dane added, just as breathlessly.
"Aye, by the gods,"
the woman answered.
"By Mialiki, most of all."
"And with the blessings of Moradin, Dumathoin, and Clangadin, don't ye doubt,"
Brunner added.
"I've been to their throne in Gontalgrim, I tell ye. Thought I'd be drinking at their hall, but they had other plans."
"And so we're here in this time of need,"
Catti Bree added. The others started to cheer, but King Emrys cut that short.
"No canna be," he said. "No.
But I knowed ye when ye were here, I did. Little Arar, I went to your ma and saw ye schooled in the fightin'."
The King of Citadel Felbar paused there, the memory catching him by surprise. He looked to Parson Glaive and Ragged Dane, and they each smiled and nodded, also recalling the way this young dwarf, the son of Reginald Roundshield, had toyed with dwarflings years beyond his age.
"No,
But it couldn't be all a lie,
Emerus insisted.
Ye was right under me eyes. Your da was me friend, captain of me guard. You canna dishonor him now in such a way.
Ain't no dishonor, Brunner insisted, shaking his head. I done what needed doing. I could not tell ye. Though don't ye doubt, but I wanted to.
Blasphemy!
Emerus shouted.
Wait!
Ragged Dane interrupted, and it seemed a fortunate coincidence that the old dwarf picked that time to slow down the momentum of King Emerus. Ragged Dane turned to Emerus and nodded an apology, and when the king bade him continue, he spun back on Brunner.
Then you're saying it was King Brunner who threw himself at that giant in the Rovens? King Brunner who gived all but his life so that his fellows could get away? Seen a giant? Stick to giant,
Brunner said matter-of-factly and with a shrug, though he did wince a bit at the painful memory.
And I? Mandarin Adoberbright?
He asked, looking to Emerus.
Know that she saved me, as did your second there, good Parson Glaive.
Ragged Dane, King Emerus, and Brunner looked to the High Priest of Felbar together, finding Parson Glaive standing and staring dumbfounded then, his jaw hanging open.
"It's true,"
he whispered breathlessly.
"Aye, so I said," Brunner replied. "Mandarin attended me, and Dane and the boys bringed me back, though I'm not for remembering much of that part."
"No,"
Parson Glaive said.
"Yourself? Ye're Brunner. And ye were Brunner then?"
"Always been,"
Brunner answered. But King Emerus waved him to silence.
"What did ye know?"
the king demanded of his high priest.
"When ye waked up after the fight in the Rovens back in Felbar,"
Parson Glaive said to Brunner,
"I tell ye that ye might have been going to meet your da. And I was meaning Arar, of course, as he went off to the Table of Moradin. But ye were half out of your wits, and ye said..."
"Banger,"
Brunner replied. King Emerus blinked repeatedly, turning from Parson Glaive to Brunner and back again.
"Even then ye knowed,"
Ragged Dane whispered.
"Always knowed, from the day of me birth."
"Always knowed? And ye didn't tell me?"
Emerus demanded. Brunner stood and bowed.
"Weren't your worry,"
was all he offered.
"And was yourself that got yourself to Mithril Hall, to train with them gutbusters, so ye said?"
Ragged Dane added.
"Hey-ho!"
Bungalow Thump had to put in. The three from Citadel Felbar exchanged looks, and Parson Glaive said with complete confidence,
"By the gods, but it's him."
"By the gods,"
Orethio Spikes and the rest of the Adbar contingent, King Emerus and Ragged Dane all shouted together, and they came to their feet as one, shaking their hairy heads, clapping each other on the back and crying,
"Huzzah to King Brunner!"
"Aye, but my hope's just brightened, and the dark sky ain't so dark,"
King Emerus proclaimed.
"Brunner, me old friend, but how is it so?"
He crawled across the table to offer a firm handshake, then pushed in closer and wrapped King Brunner in a great hug.
"Drinks, drinks," he yelled to the attendants. "Oh, but we'll be putting them back for a 10 day and more. Huzzah for Brunner!"
And the cheering began anew, and the attendants came rushing in, foam flying, and the somber council quickly became a cacophony of toasts and cheers. Brunner let the celebration go on for a while, but finally begged them all to take their seats once more.
"Not much to be cheering if the Silver March is at a fall,"
he warned.
"And ye're King of Mithril Hall again?"
Emerus asked Brunner as soon as they had all settled back into their seats. The King of Citadel Felbar looked to Conorad as he spoke the dangerous question. Brunner too glanced over at Conorad, who nodded. In that moment, it looked to all that Conorad would go along with whatever Brunner decided. That subservience was not lost on King Emerus and Ragged Dane, both of whom gasped at the sight.
"Nah,"
said Brunner.
Best choice meself ever made as king was giving me crown to Beinach Braunanvil, and him to his boy Conorad. Mithril Hall's got a king, and as fine a king as she's e'er known. An ungrateful wretch I'd be if I called for me throne back now.
Then what? Asked Emerus.
I been to Nesme, and left Nesme right afore she fell, so you're saying, Brunner answered. Me and me friends have come to tell ye to get out of your holes. Now's the time, or there's no time to be found. The land's crawling with orcs, and they ain't meaning to go back to their holes. Nah, they're taking it all, I tell ye.
We've heard as much from the couriers of the knights in silver, Conorad added.
Bah! But what do we care for them human lands, King Emerus spouted. Laying all the blame at our feet, at your own feet, if you're who ye claim to be and who we think ye to be.
I am. And so they will, and so I won't be caring, Brunner declared. I'm knowing better. Me name's on that damned treaty, aye. But was the other kingdoms what put it there 100 years ago, and yourselves knowing the truth of that, me friend?
King Emerus nodded.
But now's no time for blaming, Brunner went on. We got thousands of orcs to kill, me boys, tens of thousands. All of Lorwar stands together, or all of Lorwar's sure to fall.
Ain't no Lorwar,
said Orethio Spikes. He rose up from his seat and slowly walked around the sharp-angled corner of the table, moving deliberately for Brunner.
Just a bunch of elves and humans dancing about three dwarf forts. I am there to fall, he said when he got right up to Brunner, and he began carefully looking over the strange dwarf. All of them, and there ain't a darned thing we can do to stop it.
We put our three as one and hammer them orcs, Brunner started.
We cannot get out,
Orethio Spikes explained. And still he looked the strange dwarf up and down, once again looking for some sign that the dwarf was an impostor, it seemed. And who could blame him? Into the midst of a besieged and battered trio of citadel comes a young dwarf claiming to be a long-dead king, and telling the dwarves to come out of their impregnable fortresses.
Oh, but we tried,
Orethio went on, and he started back for his seat.
King Harnoth won't stay in his hall. So full of grief is he for his brother Brom, who got himself murdered to death in the Cold Vale. I seen that murder, aye. Me king frozen to death by the blow of a white dragon. Aye, a true dragon, I tell ye. And then me dear king got his head cut away by the ugliest orc, Warlord Hartusk of Dark Arrow Keep. Oh, aye, young Brunner, if that's to be your name, he added, and looked past Brunner to Driz. And riding the worm was a drow elf, much akin to the one ye bringed in with ye.
He turned his eyes squarely on Brunner.
We'd lose half our dwarves and more trying to get out of Adbar. Damned orcs canna get in, but me boys canna get out, and I ain't for losing half of them trying. Or might that be what you're looking to see?
The thick suspicion in Orethio's voice was not lost on Brunner or any of the others from Mithril Hall. And again, who could blame him?
I'm hearing ye, Brunner assured him, nodding solemnly. And me old heart's breaking for your King Brom. A good one, I hear, though I knowed his da better, to be sure.
With a glance at Conorad, Brunner leaped upon the table and stood to address them all.
And I ain't saying, and let none be saying, that we're to crawl out and lose half our boys, not for the silver marches, nay. But we're better off by far in saving what's left of the place, and not giving all the land above us to them damned orcs.
How then? Asked Orethio Spikes. Adbar canna get out, and the rings around Felbar and Mithril Hall ain't any thinner.
One's got to lead, Brunner said. One to break out and go to help the next in line. If we're talking smart back and forth, we can coax the orcs off the next and smash them from both sides.
Then two free to go to the third. Adbar'd be me guess. And we're out and running, said King Emerus.
Brunner nodded.
Aye, but who then? Asked Orethio Spikes. Who's first out? For sure that hole's to suffer like none have been punched since Obold first came down from the spine of the world."
Emerith nodded grimly at Erethio's reasoning, then slowly swung around to regard Brunner.
"It'll be the boys from Mithril Hall,"
Conrad answered before Brunner could, and all three turned to him with surprise.
"Aye,"
Conrad said, nodding.
"I know none of your blaming Mithril Hall and me friend Brunner for what's come crashing down on us, but it's right that me and me boys find our way out. Out and over to Felbar is me guess."
Emerus looked to Brunner, who shrugged and deferred back to the rightful king of Mithril Hall.
"We'll find a way," Conrad insisted, "or I am a bearded gnome."
Brunner started to agree, but that last remark, once his trademark vow, caught him off guard so completely that he nearly toppled off the table. He stared at Conrad, who offered him a grin and a wink in explanation.
"Well, huzzah and hey-ho to Mithril Hall, then," said King Emerus. "And if you're finding your way out and across the Cerberin, know that Felbar'll be itching to get out and join ye in the slaughter." "You're talking months," Erethio Spikes reminded them all, "for winter's soon to be deep about us." "Then yourself's to keep the way from Adbar to Felbar open," King Emerus told him. "And Felbar'll keep the way clear to Mithril Hall while Conrad and his boys get ready to break them orcs." "So there you have our answer, King Brunner, me old friend," Emerus went on. "I got no love for the folk of Silvery Moon or Everlund, nor am I losing much sleep for the folk of Sundabar. Aye, but they've treated your memory with disrespect and called me own boys cowards for the slaughter at the Red Run. And now I wouldn't lose a boy to save a one of them towns. But aye, you're right in that we're better with them orcs chased off and killed to death. Ye get yourselves out and we'll watch for ye."
He shifted his gaze to take in Conrad as well. "But if ye can all get out, ye won't be finding Felbar leading the way up."
"Nor Adbar,"
Erethio Spikes warned. Brunner and Conrad exchanged concerned glances. Then Brunner looked over to Drizzt, who nodded. They really couldn't have asked for more than that. None were happy after leaving that meeting that day in Citadel Felbar, but the whispering echoed in every hall in Felbar soon after, as word that their own little RR had returned with his spectacular announcement. King Brunner? Could it be? Eoin Roundshield was hard at work at her blacksmithing when she heard the whispers. She wasted no time in closing down her forge and heading back to her home. Overwhelmed and confused, she didn't want to discuss the startling news. She really had no idea how she actually felt about it. If the whispers were true, she was the Queen Mother of Mithril Hall, a place she had never even visited and of which she knew almost nothing. Whatever excitement that strange and unexpected title might inspire were surely tempered, though. If this was King Brunner, then what of her little RR? What of the child she had nurtured? For 18 years he had been her boy. Not without trials, certainly, but not without love, either. But how much of it was a lie? She thought of the last month he had been in her home, itching to be on the road to Mithril Hall. So he knew then, she realized. Possibly he had known for all his life. And he hadn't told her. She dropped her thick apron on the counter in her entry hall and plopped down heavily on a chair at her dining table, feeling much older than her 110 years. How she missed her husband in this difficult moment. She needed someone to lean on, someone to help her sort through this insanity.
"I come home, Ma,"
came a familiar voice from the hallway behind her. Eoin froze in place, her thoughts whirling.
"I hope you're to forgive me for going to King Emerus first. But I seen the war and it's no pretty thing,"
Brunner said, moving slowly toward the woman. Eoin couldn't look over at him. She kept her head bowed into her hands, trying to clear her mind, trying to throw aside her fears and grief and simply let her heart guide her. She heard her boy approaching and couldn't deny the flutter in her heart.
Ma, Brunner said, dropping a hand on her shoulder. Ewing spun on him and leaped up from her seat, and even in the motion she wasn't sure whether she'd punch him or hug him. She went with a hug, crushing her boy tight against her. He reciprocated, and Ewing felt the warmth, the sincere love coming back at her. King Brunner, they're saying, she whispered.
Aye, 'tis true.
But that's a part of me, he whispered back.
Ewing's boy, Reginald's boy I be, and proud of it, don't ye doubt.
But you're this other one, too,
Ewing said when she composed herself. She pulled back a bit to look her son in the eye.
Aye. Brunner Battlehammer, son of Bangor and Cadia, and don't ye know but that I'm shaking me head every time I'm thinking about it?
Brunner replied with a self-deprecating laugh.
Two Ma's, two Da's, two lines of blood.
And one's royal.
Brunner nodded.
Still got me royal blood. Been to Gontalgrim, to the throne of the dwarf gods, and ye cannot sit on it if—
His voice trailed away, and Ewing blushed, recognizing that she hadn't hid her disinterest well enough. She didn't care about his other Ma and Da, or this whole King Brunner business. Nay, this was her little RR, and not some Battlehammer.
I'm not meaning to hurt ye, Brunner said. It's the last thing I'd be wanting to do.
Then what's this craziness that's coming over ye?
It's not. Me name's Brunner, always been. By the grace of a goddess was I brought back from the grave.
So someone telled ye?
No, Brunner said somberly, shaking his head. No, it is not a tale needin' telling, for it's one I've walked awake.
And what's that meanin'?
Ewing started to ask, but Brunner's expression, deadly serious and certain, clued her to another direction.
How long ye knowin' this?
Whole time.
And what's that to mean?
Whole time, Brunner repeated. From me old life to me death, to the forest of Catibree's goddess, to the womb of Ewing, I knowed who I was.
From the moment ye was born again?
Before, Brunner said.
Ewing fell back, overwhelmed, confused, and horrified to think that she held some sentient, knowing adult creature in her womb. What was he claiming? What madness was this?
He spent the better part of a year in me belly, you're saying? She gasped.
No, Brunner replied. I come in as I was coming out, at the time of birth.
Oh, but you're a fat liar.
No.
No babes to be knowing that. No memories go that far back for any of us.
Brunner shrugged.
I can tell ye every bit of the day your husband, me da, did not come back. When Parson Glaive and King Emerus come to your door.
Before she could even think of the motion, Ewing slugged him in the face. She gasped and brought her hands to her mouth, tears flowing freely.
You knew in the crib?
She asked breathlessly.
Ye knew, and ye did not tell me. What madness?
I could know.
And ye'd not have believed me,
Brunner said. He gave a little snort.
Are ye even believing me now, I'm wondering? It was me own secret and me own burden and why I had to go.
To Mithril Hall?
She tried to sound understanding, now that her anger had manifested itself with the strike. She had let her horror overtake her, but only briefly, she decided, only briefly.
Through Mithril Hall, Brunner answered, and all the way to the Sword Coast.
Did ye tell him, them boys from Mithril Hall?
Nah, Brunner said, shaking his head. Not till I come back now with me friends aside me. And some of them went through death, too. That was the deal with the goddess, and I was oath-bound. And oh, don't ye doubt that the throne of our gods let me know their anger when I was thinking of breaking that oath.
You keep claiming the gods are on your side, then?
I know what I know, and I know who I be. And I be Brunner and remember all of that other life I knew, the life afore I died. Yui nodded, beginning to digest it all, and telling herself that she had no choice but to accept it.
And you're still me ma, I'm hoping. But course the call's your own to make.
Yuen started to nod. How could she not love this one, even if he wasn't? The woman froze, her face looking into an expression of pure shock.
Me own boy,
she finally managed to whisper after a long, long pause.
Me own boy.
Aye, if ye'll have me.
Not yourself. Me boy, what was in there?
She said and rubbed her belly.
What did ye do to him then? Where's me boy, a Reginald Seed?
Brunner sucked in his breath and held up his hands helplessly, clearly at a loss.
Yuen believed him.
He had no answer as to how that transformation might have occurred, of how he had gotten into the tiny body in the womb and what had been there before him. Had the child been a blank slate awaiting the consciousness of Brunner Battlehammer? Or some other maybe, and so expelled? Was that the way it worked?
Get yourself out of me house, ye murdering dog!
The woman said, trembling and with tears pouring down her cherubic cheeks.
Oh, ye doppelganger! Abomination, ye killed me, baby!
As she ranted, she pushed Brunner toward the door, and he gave ground, shaking his head with every step. But he couldn't deny her charges, and could only hold his hands up helplessly, clueless. Yuen shoved him outside and slammed her door in his face, and he could hear her wailing from behind the stone. He staggered away, but had only gone a few steps before a ragged Dane caught up to him.
"Come on, then, ye fool king," the dwarf said lightheartedly. "Might be the greatest swarm of orcs of Bolas the world's e'er seen, but ho, we're still to drink to King Brunner this day. The gods have blessed us. They sent ye here for a reason,"
he said, dragging Brunner along.
"We'll be singing and dancing and drinking all the night, don't ye doubt?"
Brunner nodded. He knew the expectation, of course, and would go along. But he kept looking back at the humble home he had known in this childhood, kept thinking of the woman he had left behind the stone door, broken and grieving. They had an army of orcs camped up above them, flooding the land, sacking the towns. But anyone looking in on the celebration that night in Citadel Felbar would never know it, for one of the most legendary dwarves of the past 2 centuries had returned from the grave, and while many in the Silver Marches grumbled about Brunner's signature on the Treaty of Garum's Gorge, the dwarves of the north were not among those naysayers. King Brunner was kin and kind, friend of Felbar, friend of Adbar, and so the celebration roared. Brunner spent the early part of the gathering beside Drizzt and Catibri. He nodded and smiled, clapped tankards, and shared hugs and well-wishes with a line of Felbaran dwarves. He did well to mask his inner turmoil over Yuen, and truthfully over the whole process that had brought him back to life and back to Toril. Had his arrival in Yuen's womb thrown aside a babe? Had he taken the infant's body like some mind flayer? The horror of that notion had him rubbing his hairy face.
"I fear for them too, my friend. But take heart," Drizzt whispered to him on one such beard-stroking.
Brunner looked at him curiously.
"Hold faith in Wulfgar and Regis,"
Catibri clarified, and she reached over and put her hand on Brunner's forearm. The reminder jolted Brunner from his other concerns. He hadn't been thinking of his lost friends at all that day. Too many other problems nipped at his every step. He nodded solemnly at his beautiful daughter and put his hand atop hers.
"Aye, the little one's grown. With him aside, Wulfgar, sure that it's them orcs we should be worrying for."
He lifted his mug and clapped it against the flagon Catibri put up, and a third came in from Drizzt, and then more as another band of well-wishers bobbed over. and on it went with cheers and promises that the orcs of Many Arrows would rue the day they came forth from their smelly keep, and every drink lifted repeatedly for Delzoon and Brunner. On one side of the room a chorus began, a troop of dwarves with tones both wistful and dulcet, singing tales of war, of victory, and great sorrow. As one song, a merrier melody, gathered momentum, some dwarves began to dance, and others called for Drizzt and Catti Bree to join in. And so they did, and soon the dwarven dancers fell back and circled them, cheering them on. Drizzt and Catti Bree had never actually danced before, and certainly not publicly. But they had trained for war together many times, sparring in mock battle, and no two creatures in Faerûn were more attuned to the movements of each other. They glided around the floor with ease, lost only in each other, moving with sympathy and grace, and not a stumble could be found. Brunner couldn't help but smile as he watched the couple, and surely it did his heart good to see the love that remained between the two. It brought him back to the days before the spell plague, when at last Catti Bree and Drizzt had admitted to, and surrendered to, their love for one another. And here it was again. No, not again, Brunner thought, but still. Eternal. He nodded and felt warm. Then he went back to clapping tankards and sharing hugs and handshakes. At one point in the procession of well-wishers, Brunner looked past Drizzt and Catti Bree, who were returning to their seats, and noted King Emerus, Ragged Dane, and Parson Glaive sitting around a small table in an animated conversation with Athrogate. Drizzt followed his gaze, then looked back to Brunner with concern. Brunner nodded and held up his hands to ward off a group coming to greet him, thinking to make his way to that table and see what Athrogate might be telling Emerus.
"Aye, but there's a slap in me face,"
a woman's voice followed him as he took a step in that direction.
"Aye, but ain't he the king now?"
another woman asked with biting sarcasm.
"Too good for the likes of us."
Brunner stopped and dropped his head to hide the smile growing within the red-orange flames of his beard, his hands going to his hips. Oh, but he knew these two.
"Might that we should kick him in the hairy butt,"
said the first, and all around other dwarves were laughing.
"Aye, and stick the one horn o' his helm up it,"
said the other. Brunner leaped around as the two dwarves charged at him, and he caught them both, or they caught him, or they all caught each other. And he got kissed. Oh, did he get kissed, on both his cheeks and flush on the lips. When he came up for air, Brunner saw Drizzt and Catti Bree standing beside him, staring at him with amused expressions. He pulled the two young ladies out to either side, keeping them firmly wrapped with his arms around their shoulders.
"Drizzt and me girl, Catti Bree, I give ye Tanna Breeches and Mala Breeches Fellhammer, two of the toughest fighters whatever whacked an orc,"
Brunner said. He looked to Tanna Breeches, then to her twin sister, noting their nicknames.
"Fist and Fury."
"Well met,"
said Tanna Breeches.
"And better met,"
added Mala Breeches.
"Glad that ye bringed us back our little RR,"
said the first.
"Ah, sister, don't ye know he's the king?" Mala Breeches scolded.
"Aye,"
Tanna Breeches lamented.
"King Brunner, we're telled." "Aye, and he ain't young. No, he's 400 if he's a day, and woe to his poor old legs." "Woe and more when we're done dancing,"
Tanna Breeches insisted, and she and her sister pulled Brunner out to the floor to the rousing cheers of all. Delighted, Drizzt and Catti Bree took their seats and watched the show as the trio bumbled, bounced, and banged their way through it all. There wasn't much graceful about their dance. At times they more resembled three famished dwarves fighting over the last beer. But truly, Drizzt and Catti Bree had never seen a purer expression of joy from their grumbling friend Brunner. And so it went, and for that night at least, the companions could forget the orcs above and their friends lost in the tunnels. Just for that one night.